Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Check the calendar for me, would you, gang? It is not 2008, even though it might be starting to feel like it. I get it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 11th day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A couple of things to frame today's conversation as we get going. Big stock market volatility again today, this time to the downside. Details at the appropriate point in the program, of course. That's the first thing. The second thing is that President Trump summoned CEOs of the big Wall Street banks to the White House this afternoon for a meeting on the crisis facing this economy. Congress and the administration, meanwhile, this is item three, are talking bailouts with very large dollar amounts attached. Now, everything I have said so far in the program today could just as easily have been the setup to this broadcast 11 years ago. Meetings, bailouts, general market unease. But this isn't that. Scary? Yes, but in a different way, actually. So we are going to spend a little bit of time on that idea at the top of the program today. Louise Shaner is a senior fellow in economics at the Brookings Institution. Dr. Shaner, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Could you, just to set the table here, explain to me and everybody how this crisis, which seems to be upon us more and more every day, is different economically than what happened in 2008?
So I think the fundamental difference between this crisis and the one in 2008 is that the one in 2008 was started by actual imbalances in the economy, particularly in the housing market. This one is totally external, right? This is coming from a health crisis. And so the causes are very different, and that means it might play out very differently. On the other hand, it might not.
Okay, fair enough. Now, what does that say about how the government might set about trying to ameliorate this?
Okay, so I think what we have to think about for this crisis is that it's really, really early, and we just don't know how it's going to play out. First of all, we want to respond to the public health crisis. Second, we want to respond to the near-term problem. And third, we want to put in place provisions now that will kick in case this thing turns out to be a lot worse and a lot more protracted than we might think it is likely to be. And I can talk about each of those in turn, if
well,
you like.
Sadly, the program's only half an hour. But fundamentally, what we're dealing with here in that third bullet is a whole bunch of Rumsfeldian unknown unknowns, right? Just because it's so early.
They're unknown unknowns, yes, but in terms of the economics, we can sort of understand what might happen, right? What might happen is that this thing that starts off as just a health crisis, first of all, lasts a lot longer than we think, and then has all these sort of add-on effects. And so what policy has to do is to take on insurance to make sure that those add-on effects don't happen, that this thing turns out to be as short as it can be and as sort of as shallow as it can be and has the least effect on the economy and least effect on people. If they're hurt, they at least have something to pay their rent, to buy food for their kids. And so that's what I think we need to do in the near term.
There is a lot of talk about what kinds of assistance the government's going to do, what kinds of aid packages and bailouts, and mm-hmm. more on that later in the program. But I want to talk big picture about how hard it is to do some of that targeting, very specific targeting, that you and others say we ought to do. I mean, the American economy is like a $20 trillion beast. It's tough to get down to a pinhead, yes?
It's exactly. It's very, very difficult to get down to a pinhead, and I don't think that's what we necessarily need to do. We want to make sure that people have access to health care, that they don't have to worry about showing up at the hospital, that they will be taken care of, and they won't suffer financially for that. The downside of not doing enough is quite large. If we let this thing get into a very bad economic outcome, that's a huge downside. The cost of doing too much is just not that very high right now with interest rates this low. And so I think we really want to err on the side of doing too much and doing it, you know, as quickly as possible.
Gotta love interest rates getting in there, because that's actually a real factor of what's going on. Last question, and then I'll let you go. And it's a little bit subjective. 2008, as those of us who remember it remember well, was really scary. For quite a while. Are you more scared now, or were you more scared then?
I think I am personally more scared now, and that's just because I think the health consequences of what could happen are just incredibly scary. You know, I mean, economics are important, and they certainly have human costs, but this really is life or death, and so I'm really quite scared, and I think it's really important that we get ahead of this and do everything we can to minimize the health costs, the cost of life. It's life and death.
Louise Shaner is a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution, also the policy director at the Hutchins Center there. Dr. Shaner, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you.
That was the macro view, if you will, of 2008 versus today. Fine. There are a whole lot more micro points of comparison to be made as well. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has them.
When the financial system was in turmoil in 2008, it was pretty easy to see which industries caused the problems and which were suffering. Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
And this, of course, was concentrated last time to the financial industry, the housing industry, ultimately the automakers were also involved.
And so they got federal government bailouts, or loans, regulatory relief, whatever you want to call it. Aaron Lockwood teaches political economy at the University of California, Irvine.
The assistance that was given to the banking and automobile industries during the 2008 financial crisis came under the heading of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which is a piece of legislation that authorized the Treasury Department to buy up troubled or illiquid assets from financial institutions with the goal of restoring liquidity and credit provision and confidence to markets.
How well that infamous TARP bailout worked is still being debated, and lawmakers are now trying to decide if industry bailouts will help this time around. Joshua Sewell at the Taxpayers for Common Sense thinks it's too early to know.
You need to stop the disease before you try to recover from the effects. If this moves beyond a stock market crisis into affecting the people's take-home pay and ability to have their kids go to school, then you should consider ways of easing the pain for the people in what we know as the real economy.
But whether that will require a bailout of the airline, cruise, or oil industries will depend on what the economy looks like when that happens. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Not for nothing, but I will note here as we head into the rest of the program that the 11-year post-financial crisis bull run on the Dow Jones Industrial Average came to a crashing end today, quickly too. 20 days, record time, from peak to 20% down. Details when we do the numbers. For all the economic downside the coronavirus is bringing, there is a boomlet of sorts going on in the mortgage market. Those low bond yields we've been telling you about have made refinancing really, really attractive. But there are still a bunch of structural problems in the housing market, chief among them being the lack of affordable new housing. You ask builders why they're not keeping up with the obvious demand in that slice of real estate, And they'll tell you that a big part of it is the high cost of building. There's land, there's labor and materials, and then there are government regulations. The National Association of Home Builders says regulatory costs, on average, account for almost a quarter of the final sale price of a new home. Marketplace's Amy Scott wanted to know what all that money pays for, so she visited a single house in suburban Maryland and added it all up.
Our house is called the Foxglove. It's a three-story townhome in Lanham, Maryland, outside D.C., built by Timberlake Homes. John Minzer is president of the family-owned business.
I married the boss's daughter. That way I didn't have to work. 42 years ago.
The Foxglove is the less expensive of two models in this brand new development of 138 homes called Wood Glen. It has three bedrooms, a balcony, and a big, bright kitchen.
It normally comes with hardwood all the way through, like you see it. This is an enlarged island, but you do get granite, and you also get the stainless steel kitchen.
And the price?
They start at $355. They are trying to be, for our area, this would be moderately priced houses.
Let's break down that $355,000. Roughly $100,000 is for the land. $150,000 goes to construction, labor and materials. There's $85,000 for business expenses like interest, insurance, marketing, and overhead, leaving about $20,000, less than 6%, for profit. But baked into all those numbers, Minzer says, are almost $40,000 in government fees.
So it really drives up the cost of housing, and unfortunately, it's really crazy. That's all I can say.
So where does all that money go? Actually, about $15,000 goes to the school district. More housing means more students. About $7,400 pays for fire, police, and emergency medical services. Then there's the toilet. Not the actual toilet. You can buy one of those for $130 at Home Depot. But if you want it connected to the sewer system...
Every fixture that's in here that where water is going to be associated with, they put a dollar amount on it.
They being the Water and Sewer Authority. For this house, that adds up to more than $5,000. Those are just some of the fees and permits. Then there are all the special things that make Wood Glen, Wood Glen, and drive up that $150,000 construction tab. Like the oddly precise requirement that 64% of the exterior be brick and the rest a special siding called hardy plank, both more expensive than vinyl.
And why do they mandate that?
Because they like the way it looks.
Minzer also had to shell out about $2,000 per unit for recreation space, including play areas for kids and a grassy space with benches and a white pergola, where he figures he could have built another four or five houses and brought the overall cost down.
I don't know anybody's ever going to sit out here. I mean, those are the type of things that I'm saying I think they could use a little bit better common sense of.
This is where the developers writing the checks come up against the officials who write the rules. They say fees for things like schools, public safety, the sewer system, infrastructure, are all based on the premise that growth should pay for growth.
New development creates a need for services in the community, and the county has to have a way to pay for those.
Derek Berlage is deputy planning director for Prince George's County. As for that pergola, he says, yeah. It's about aesthetics.
It's a balancing act. No one wants to put in place requirements that will restrain good development from happening. But on the other hand, communities don't want to see low-quality development either.
And builder John Minzer gets that.
You know what? I'm not going to knock them completely because I understand what their goal is. Their goal is to make livable communities and make it look, you know, very good. But if the goal is to try to keep housing down, you could probably eliminate a whole lot of that stuff.
And maybe let the market decide what's attractive?
If I put up a crap box, nobody's going to buy my house.
Some relief may be on the way. The county council just passed a new zoning ordinance that opens up more land to building and gives developers more flexibility in whether they use, say, hardy plank or vinyl. In Prince George's County, Maryland, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's beef tripe stewed with chilies and oregano and garlic and onions.
How about a break from all the grim virus news, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 1,464 points today, 5.8%, 23,553 in the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 392 points, 4.7%, 79.52. The S&P 500 off 140 points, 4.8%, 27.41 today. Boeing already in some trouble for reasons we have told you about. Said it's suspending new hiring and restricting employees' travel due to COVID-19. Boeing off more than 18% today. Delta and United Airlines both declined more than 6%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose. It went up to 0.87%. That's amazing. You're listening to Marketplace. The last couple of weeks have reminded us how quickly things can change in the global economy and here at home. Marketplace is here to keep you grounded and informed. No sensationalism, no fear-mongering, just the facts. As a nonprofit news organization, we count on your support to make this work possible. So please donate $30 or more right now, and you'll also get a Marketplace t-shirt as a thank you gift. Become a Marketplace investor today at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You may or may not be the kind of person who stocks up on things when times are looking scary, like they are now. But plenty of other people are that kind of person, and they have been out buying canned goods and hand sanitizer and, as you have surely seen, toilet paper. There is, because you knew there would be, an economic concept at play here. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains scarcity.
Every few months, Danielle DeSantis and her husband Robert go to a local Costco near Denver to stock up on things like meat and peanut butter and toilet paper. But when they went the other day,
there was no toilet paper. There was no paper towels. And a woman came up and asked, "What about napkins? Are there napkins?" And the Costco employee just laughed at her.
A friend told her that Home Depot, which apparently sells toilet paper, was still in stock. They bought a 12-pack of Charmin.
And still I was like, but maybe I need more. And my husband, thank God, is the more pragmatic of the two of us. And he was like, "Danielle, 12 rolls will get you through 14 days of quarantine and many more."
DeSantis walked into the Costco, a calm, collected consumer, and walked out ready to stockpile toilet paper in her basement. There is a rational reason that people are buying staple items like toilet paper at a time like this. They worry that soon they might not be able to get to the store or the store might be closed. But you probably don't need a year's supply. And the impulse to overbuy, which DeSantis had when she looked at those empty shelves, has a lot to do with the economic concept of scarcity. Adam Alter teaches marketing and psychology at the NYU Stern School of Business.
Yeah, scarcity is a really powerful driver of consumption.
Alter says when you go to the store and see that there's no toilet paper left,
it signals to me that this is something that is in short supply. If I can find it somewhere, I should buy more of it than usual because there's a chance that other people will be buying in the same way and there'll be less and less of it. This is the kind of snowball effect,
which can lead to even more panic buying. Now, this is true of all kinds of products. So why toilet paper in particular? Alter says it's considered a basic hygiene item in the U.S., and people don't really want to think about what it'd be like to go without it. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
You could say that online dating is already a kind of social distancing, right? Meet people virtually while you decide whether or not you want to meet them in person. But with coronavirus upon us, the epidemiological kind of social distancing has become a thing. So what then becomes of Tinder and OkCupid and Bumble, Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports on looking for love in what may be all the wrong places.
Thomas Jaron is pretty active in the world of online dating. He's on Tinder and Grindr, goes on one or two dates a week. But this week, Jaron, who is 25 and lives in Oregon, canceled every date.
I feel like a little bit like Chicken Little for it, but I canceled that date. And then I had some things planned for this weekend that I'm canceling as we speak.
Jaron's not telling people that he's canceling because he's worried about getting COVID-19.
I'm so ashamed to admit it.
Analysts say online dating apps are bound to take a hit. Ali Mogarabi is with Morningstar.
Now, as the virus keeps spreading, that fear is going to increase. What that means for the company is it's going to result in, you know, higher churn and less growth in their subscribers. I mean, you look at the stock and it's certainly come down a lot.
The dating apps are starting to make adjustments to the new reality. Tinder has canceled the international release of Swipe Night, a choose-your-own-adventure series that was scheduled to launch internationally this weekend. And the company has added a pop-up screen that reminds people to wash their hands and not touch their faces. But analyst Mogherabi says in the long run, dating apps are likely to remain profitable.
In our opinion, after growth in the coronavirus cases plateaus, or let's just say slow down, you know, fears begin to subside.
For now, though, Netflix and chill might be something you want to do on your own. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Back when the trade war was the big economic story, we did a bunch of work about Mexico and our trading relationship with them, which is critical. Of course, Mexico is one of this country's biggest trading partners. We didn't often, though, tell stories on this program of the people and the places in Mexico. So it is good for us, then, that Rick Martinez, he's a contributing editor at Bon Appetit, is on a driving trip through Mexico, food and culture and some economy, state by state down there. We got him on the phone from Zacatecas. Rick, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
First things first, I suppose, is I have to figure out where you are. Where have we found you?
All right. So I am in a town called Zacatecas, in the state of Zacatecas, which is about 500 miles northwest of Mexico City. So it's slightly in the northern part of the country. It's a 16th century Spanish colonial mining town. It's really, really beautiful.
I will say I'm looking at your Instagram right now, and it's I'm liking the pictures both of the place and of the food, which gets us to why we're talking to you. This is a multi-stage project you got going on here, right? Give me the backstory.
So I've been wanting to write a book about the food of Mexico. I feel like, you know, myself included, but I think most Americans have a very limited scope of what they understand to be Mexican food. And the reality is Mexico is a huge country with a lot of different geography, a lot of different cultures and indigenous people, and a lot of immigration from different parts of the world that have contributed to the cuisine. And I wanted to share that and bring that to light in the United States. So I went to Mexico City, I bought a car, and I am driving across the country. I'm hitting all 31 states plus Mexico City, which is sort of like another state in and of itself. And so far, I've hit 84 cities and 22 states and about 10,000 miles.
Tell me about the 10,000 miles you've put on that car. What I want to know specifically is... economically, what are you seeing? Are you seeing opportunity? Are you seeing hardship? Are you seeing, what are you seeing?
You know, I'm seeing everything. I think that one of the things that strikes me most about this country and the people in this country is that they're incredibly optimistic and incredibly happy and incredibly hard workers. You know, there are cities like, for example, one of my favorite cities, Juchitán, which is in Oaxaca. And that town has been devastated by earthquakes. It hasn't gotten a lot of money from the government to rebuild. And a lot of the buildings, particularly in the center of town, are still destroyed and abandoned. But the building that housed the Mercado has now just moved to the streets. And it's almost like a 24/7 Mercado. So they're out on the streets, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning selling tamales and guisos and tacos and... And that's the thing that I really love about this country is the people are so warm and inviting, and they're willing to share with you whatever they have, and even if they don't have that much.
Tell me about going to the market there in Zacatecas. What are you seeing in the stalls, and what's your favorite thing to eat?
The food is pretty incredible. Because it's a Spanish silver town, it's a little bit more influenced from colonial Spain. For example, in this part of the country, enchiladas are a big deal here. So enchiladas Zacatecas. I had some amazing menudo yesterday for breakfast. It was actually probably one of the best breakfasts I've had on this trip. It was a big bowl of menudo, which is a basically it's tripe. It's beef tripe stewed with chilies and oregano and garlic and onions. And I had a big glass of freshly squeezed orange juice, which I love. I mean, it's citrus season down here, so a lot of the states in the north have amazing citrus farms. But that was an incredible breakfast. And that was just a little stand along the streets. And all this woman, Doña Lupe, all that she sold was menudo in the mornings. And she just sold it until she ran out. And that was it.
It sounds amazing. What's your next stop?
My next stop, there is a town called Los Pinos. It's a really beautiful small town, and one of the main reasons I'm going there, there's a master of ceramics and pottery, and he's been recognized by the Mexican government as being a master in his craft. And one of the things that I'm doing, I'm collecting plates and dishes and pottery to use as props for the recipes in the book, so that all of the recipes are served and shot on plates from the regions that the food comes from.
Rick Martinez, contributing food editor at Bon Appetit, cookbook to come. And Rick, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Tell you what, if you want some good food, Instagram, Rick's feed is at rick.andrew.martinez. If you want to follow along, I do. That cookbook, as I said, that he's working on isn't coming out for a while, but he does have a bunch of recipes for tacos in the March issue of Bon Appetit, so you can look for that. Final note on the way out today, enforced social distancing edition, and one imagines here that basketball is just the tip of the athletic iceberg. The NCAA announced today that March Madness, and in fact all of its championship events, are going to happen without anybody in the seats. Essential staff and limited family are the exceptions. For the record, you should know that the NCAA and the schools themselves make way more money from their television contracts than they do from ticket sales. People are really losing from this. The people selling beer and t-shirts and manning the concessions in all those arenas. All right, we are done. Dow Industrials off 1,464 today. That is now officially a bear market. NASDAQ down 392. S&P 500 down 140. All about 4 or 5%. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Robin Edgar, Drew Josta, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.